He didn't have to be south of the Mason-Dixon line to hate niggers. He just did. Nope, it was the fire at the black spot that convinced me of that. You know, Mikey, in a way... He glanced over at my mother, who was knitting. She hadn't looked up, but I knew she was listening closely, and my father knew it too, I think. In a way, it was the fire made me a man. There were 60 people killed in that fire, 18 of them from Company E. There really wasn't any company left when that fire was over. Henry Whitson, Stork Anson, Alan Snopes, Everett McCaslin, Horton Satoris, all my friends, all dead in that fire. And that fire wasn't set by old Sarge Wilson and his grits and cornpone friends. It was set by the Derry branch of the Maine Legion of White Decency. Some of the kids you go to school with, son, their fathers struck the matches that lit the black spot on fire. And I'm not talking about the poor kids, neither. Why, Daddy? Why did they? Well, part of it was just Derry, my father said, frowning. He lit his pipe slowly and shook out the wooden match. I don't know why it happened here. I can't explain it, but at the same time, I ain't surprised by it. The Legion of White Decency was the Northerners' version of the Ku Klux Klan, you see. They marched in the same white sheets, they burned the same crosses, they wrote the same hate notes to black folks they felt were getting above their station or taking jobs that were meant for white men. In churches where the preachers talked about black equality, they sometimes planted charges of dynamite. Most of the history books talk more about the KKK than they do about the Legion of White Decency, and a lot of people don't even know there was such a thing. I think it might be because most of the histories have been written by Northerners and they're ashamed. It was most popular in the big cities and the manufacturing areas. New York, New Jersey, Detroit, Baltimore, Boston, Portsmouth. They all had their chapters. They tried to organize in Maine, but Derry was the only place they had any real success. Oh, for a while there was a pretty good chapter in Lewiston. This was around the same time as the fire at the Black Spot. But they weren't worried about niggers raping white women or taking jobs that should have belonged to white men because there weren't any niggers to speak of up here. In Lewiston, they were worried about tramps and hobos, and that something called the Bonus Army would join up with something they called the Communist Riffraff Army, by which they meant any man who was out of work. The Legion of Decency used to send these fellows out of town just as fast as they came in. Sometimes they stuffed poison ivy down the backs of their pants. Sometimes they set their shirts on fire. Well, the Legion was pretty much done up here after the fire at the Black Spot. Things got out of hand, you see. The way things seem to do in this town sometimes. He paused, puffing. It's like the Legion of White Decency was just another seed, Mikey, and it found some earth that nourished it well here. It was a regular rich man's club, and after the fire, they all just laid away their sheets and lied each other up, and it was papered over. Now there was a kind of vicious contempt in his voice that made my mother look up, frowning. After all, who got killed? 18 army niggers, 14 or 15 town niggers, 4 members of a nigger jazz band, and a bunch of nigger lovers. What did it matter? Will, my mother said softly, that's enough. No, I said, I want to hear. It's getting to be your bedtime, Mikey, he said, ruffling my hair with his big hard hand. I just want to tell you one thing more, and I don't think you'll understand it, because I'm not sure I understand it myself. What happened that night at the Black Spot, bad as it was, I don't really think it happened because we was black. Not even because the spot was close behind West Broadway, where the rich whites and Derry lived then and still live today. I don't think that the Legion of White Decency happened to get along so well here because they hated black people and bums more in Derry than they did in Portland or Lewiston or Brunswick. It's because of that soil. It seems that bad things, hurtful things, do right well in the soil of this town. I've thought so again and again over the years. I don't know why it should be, but it is. But there are good folks here, too, and there were good folks here then. When the funerals were held afterward, thousands of people turned out, and they turned out for the blacks as well as the whites. Businesses closed up for most of the week. The hospitals treated the hurt ones free of charge. There were food baskets and letters of condolence that were honestly meant. And there were helping hands held out. I met my friend Dewey Conroy during that time, and you know he's just as white as vanilla ice cream, but I feel like he's my brother. I'd die for Dewey if he asked me to, and although no man really knows another man's heart, I think he'd die for me if it came to that. Anyway, the Army sent away those of us that were left after that fire, like they were ashamed. And I guess they were. I ended up down at Fort Hood, and I stayed there for 6 years. I met your mother there, and we were married in Galveston at her folks' house. But all through the years between, Derry never escaped my mind. And after the war, I brought your mom back here, and we had you. And here we are, not 3 miles from where the black spot stood in 1930. And I think it's your bedtime, Mr. Man. I want to hear about the fire, I yelled. Tell me about it, Daddy. And he looked at me in that frowning way that always shut me up, maybe because he didn't look that way often. Mostly, he was a smiling man. That's no story for a boy, he said. Another time, Mikey, when we've both walked around a few more years. As it turned out, we both walked around another 4 years before I heard the story of what happened at the black spot that night, and by then my father's walking days were all done. He told me from the hospital bed where he lay, full of dope, dozing in and out of reality as the cancer worked away inside of his intestines, eating him up. February 26th, 1985. I got reading over what I had written last in this notebook and surprised myself by bursting into tears over my father, who has now been dead for 23 years. I can remember my grief for him. It lasted for almost 2 years. Then when I graduated from high school in 1965 and my mother looked at me and said, "How proud your father would have been." We cried in each other's arms and I thought that was the end, that we had finished the job of burying him with those late tears. But who knows how long a grief may last? Isn't it possible that even 30 or 40 years after the death of a child or a brother or a sister, one may half waken thinking of that person with that same lost emptiness, that feeling of places which may never be filled, perhaps not even in death? He left the Army in 1937 with a disability pension. By that year, my father's Army had become a good deal more warlike. Anyone with half an eye, he told me once, could see by then that soon all the guns would be coming out of storage again. He had risen to the rank of sergeant in the interim, and he had lost most of his left foot when a new recruit who was so scared he was almost shitting peach pits pulled the pin on a hand grenade and then dropped it instead of throwing it. It rolled over to my father and exploded with a sound that was, he said, like a cough in the middle of the night. A lot of the ordnance those long-ago soldiers had to train with was either defective or had sat so long in almost forgotten supply depots that it was impotent. They had bullets that wouldn't fire and rifles that sometimes exploded in their hands when the bullets did fire. The Navy had torpedoes that usually didn't go where they were aimed and didn't explode when they did. The Army Air Corps and the Navy Air Arm had planes whose wings fell off if they landed hard, and at Pensacola in 1939, I have read, a supply officer discovered a whole fleet of government trucks that wouldn't run because cockroaches had eaten the rubber hoses and the fan belts. So my father's life was saved, including, of course, the part of him that became your obedient servant, Michael Hanlon, by a combination of bureaucratic pork-barreling, falderol, and defective equipment. The grenade only half exploded, and he just lost part of one foot instead of everything from the breastbone on down. Because of the disability money, he was able to marry my mother a year earlier than he had planned. They didn't come to Derry at once. They moved to Houston, where they did war work until 1945. My father was a foreman in a factory that made bomb casings. My mother was a Rosie the Riveter. But as he told me that night when I was 11, the thought of Derry never escaped his mind. And now I wonder if that blind thing might not have been at work even then, drawing him back so I could take my place in that circle in the barrens that August evening. If the wheels of the universe are untrue, then good always compensates for evil. But good can be awful as well. My father had a subscription to the Derry News. He kept his eye on the ads announcing land for sale. They had saved up a good bit of money. At last he saw a farm for sale that looked like a good proposition, on paper at least. The two of them rode up from Texas on a Trailways bus, looked at it, and bought it the same day. The First Merchants of Penobscot County issued my father a 10-year mortgage, and they settled down. "We had some problems at first," my father said another time. "There were people who didn't want Negroes in the neighborhood. We knew it was going to be that way. I hadn't forgotten about the black spot. And we just hunkered down to wait it out. Kids would go by and throw rocks or beer cans. I must have replaced 20 windows that first year. And some of them weren't just kids, either. One day, when we got up, there was a swastika painted on the side of the chicken house and all the chickens were dead. Someone had poisoned their feed. Those were the last chickens I ever tried to keep. But the county sheriff, there wasn't any police chief in those days, Derry wasn't quite big enough for such a thing, got to work on the matter, and he worked hard. That's what I mean, Mikey, when I say there is good here as well as bad. It didn't make any difference to that man, Sullivan, that my skin was brown and my hair was kinky. He come out half a dozen times, he talked to people, and finally he found out who done it. And who do you think it was? I'll give you three guesses, and the first two don't count. I don't know, I said. My father laughed until tears spouted out of his eyes. He took a big white handkerchief out of his pocket and wiped them away. Why, it was Butch Bowers, that's who. The father of the kid you say is the biggest bully at your school. The father's a turd and the son's a little fart. There are kids at school who say Henry's father is crazy, I told him. I think I was in the fourth grade at that time, far enough along to have had my can righteously kicked by Henry Bowers more than once anyway. And now that I think about it, most of the pejorative terms for black or Negro I've ever heard, I heard first from the lips of Henry Bowers, between grades 1 and 4. Well, I'll tell you, he said, the idea that Butch Bowers is crazy might not be far wrong. People said he was never right after he come back from the Pacific. He was in the Marines over there. Anyway, the sheriff took him into custody, and Butch was hollering that it was a put-up job, and they were all just a bunch of nigger lovers. Oh, he was going to sue everybody. I guess he had a list that would have stretched from here to Witcham Street. I doubt if he had a single pair of underdrawers that was whole in the seat, but he was going to sue me, Sheriff Sullivan, the town of Derry, the county of Penobscot, and God alone knows who else. As to what happened next, well, I can't swear it's true, but this is how I heard it from Dewey Conroy. Dewey said the sheriff went in to see Butch at the jail up in Bangor, and Sheriff Sullivan says, it's time for you to shut your mouth and do some listening, Butch. That black guy, he don't want to press charges. He don't want to send you to Shawshank. He just wants the worth of his chickens. He figures $200 would do her. Butch tells the sheriff he can put his $200 where the sun don't shine, and Sheriff Sullivan, he tells Butch, they got a lime pit down at the shank, Butch, and they tell me after you've been working there about 2 years, your tongue goes as green as a lime popsicle. Now you pick. 2 years peeling lime, or $200. What do you think? No jury in Maine will convict me, Butch says, not for killing a nigger's chickens. I know that, Sullivan says. Then what the Christ are we chinning about? Butch asks him. You better wake up, Butch. They won't put you away for the chickens, but they will put you away for the swastika you painted on the door after you killed them. Well, Dewey said Butch's mouth just kind of dropped open, and Sullivan went away to let him think about it. About 3 days later, Butch told his brother, the one that froze to death a couple of years after while out hunting drunk, to sell his new Mercury, which Butch had bought with his muster out pay and was mighty sweet on. So I got my $200, and Butch swore he was going to burn me out. He went around telling all his friends that. So I caught up with him one afternoon. He'd bought an old pre-war Ford to replace the Merc, and I had my pickup. I cut him off out on Witcham Street by the train yards and got out with my Winchester rifle. Any fires out my way, and you got one bad black man gunning for you, old hoss, I told him. You can't talk to me that way, nigger, he said, and he was damn near to blubbering between being mad and being scared. You can't talk to no white man that way, not a jig like you. Well, I'd had enough of the whole thing, Mikey, and I knew if I didn't scare him off for good right then, I'd never be shed of him. There wasn't nobody around. I reached in that Ford with one hand and caught him by the hair of the head. I put the stock of my rifle against the buckle of my belt and got the muzzle right up under his chin. I said, the next time you call me a nigger or a jig, your brains are going to be dripping off the dome light of your car. And you believe me, Butch, any fire's out my way and I'm gunning for you. I may come gunning for your wife and your brat and your no-count brother as well. I have had enough. Then he did start to cry, and I never saw an uglier sight in my life. Look what things has come to here, he says, when a feller can put a gun to a working man's head in broad daylight by the side of the road. Yeah, the world must be going to a camp-meeting hell when something like that can happen, I agreed. But that don't matter now. All that matters now is, do we have an understanding here, or do you want to see if you can learn how to breathe through your forehead? He allowed us how we had an understanding, and that was the last bit of trouble I ever had with Butch Bowers, except for maybe when your dog, Mr. Chips, died, and I've got no proof that was Bowers' doing. Chippy might have just got a poison bait or something. Since that day, we've been pretty much left alone to make our way, and when I look back on it, there ain't much I regret. We've had a good life here, and if there are nights when I dream about that fire, well, there isn't nobody that can live a natural life without having a few bad dreams. February 28, 1985. It's been days since I sat down to write the story of the fire at the Black Spot as my father told it to me, and I haven't gotten to it yet. It's in The Lord of the Rings, I think, where one of the characters says that way leads on to way, that you could start at a path leading nowhere more fantastic than from your own front steps to the sidewalk, and from there you could go, well, anywhere at all. It's the same way with stories. One leads to the next, and to the next. Maybe they go in the direction you wanted to go, but maybe they don't. Maybe in the end it's the voice that tells the stories more than the stories themselves that matters. It's his voice that I remember, certainly. My father's voice, low and slow, how he would chuckle sometimes or laugh outright. The pauses to light his pipe or to blow his nose or to go and get a can of Narragansett. Nasty Gansett, he called it, from the icebox. That voice, which is for me somehow the voice of all voices, the voice of all years, the ultimate voice of this place, one that's in none of the Ives interviews nor in any of the poor histories of this place, nor on any of my own tapes. My father's voice. Now it's 10 o'clock. The library closed an hour ago, and a proper old geezer is starting to crank up outside. I can hear tiny spicules of sleet striking the windows in here and in the glassed-in corridor which leads to the children's library. I can hear other sounds, too. Stealthy creaks and bumps outside the circle of light where I sit, writing on the lined yellow pages of a legal pad. Just the sounds of an old building settling, I tell myself. But I wonder. As I wonder if somewhere out in this storm there is a clown selling balloons tonight. Well, never mind. I think I've finally found my way to my father's final story. I heard it in his hospital room no more than 6 weeks before he died. I went to see him with my mother every afternoon after school, and alone every evening. My mother had to stay home and do the chores then, but she insisted that I go. I rode my bike. She wouldn't let me hook rides, not even 4 years after the murders had ended. That was a hard 6 weeks for a boy who was only 15. I loved my father, but I came to hate those evening visits, watching him shrink and shrivel, watching the pain lines spread and deepen on his face. Sometimes he would cry, although he tried not to. And going home, it would be getting dark, and I would think back to the summer of 58, and I'd be afraid to look behind me because the clown might be there, or the werewolf, or Ben's mummy, or my bird. But I was mostly afraid that no matter what shape it took, it would have my father's cancer-rattled face. So I would pedal as fast as I could, no matter how hard my heart thundered in my chest, and come in flushed and sweaty-haired and out of breath, and my mother would say, "Why do you want to ride so fast, Mikey? You'll make yourself sick." And I'd say, "I wanted to get back in time to help you with the chores." And she'd give me a hug and kiss and tell me I was a good boy. As time went on, it got so I could hardly think of things to talk about with him anymore. Riding into town, I'd rack my brain for subjects of conversation, dreading the moment when both of us would run out of things to say. His dying scared me and enraged me, but it embarrassed me, too. It seemed to me then, and it seems to me now, that when a man or woman goes, it should be a quick thing. The cancer was doing more than killing him. It was degrading him, demeaning him. We never spoke of the cancer, and in some of those silences I thought that we must speak of it, that there would be nothing else, and we would be stuck with it like kids caught without a place to sit in a game of musical chairs when the piano stops, and I would become almost frantic trying to think of something, anything, to say so that we would not have to acknowledge the thing which was now destroying my daddy, who had once taken Butch Bowers by the hair and jammed his rifle into the shelf of his chin and demanded of Butch to be left alone. We would be forced to speak of it, and if we were, I would cry. I wouldn't be able to help it. And at 15, I think the thought of crying in front of my father scared and distressed me more than anything else. It was during one of those interminable, scary pauses that I asked him again about the fire at the black spot. They'd filled him full of dope that evening because the pain was very bad, and he had been drifting in and out of consciousness, sometimes speaking clearly, sometimes speaking in that exotic language I think of as sleep mud. Sometimes I knew he was talking to me, but at other times he seemed to have confused me with his brother Phil. I asked him about the black spot for no real reason. It had just jumped into my mind, and I seized on it. His eyes sharpened, and he smiled a little. "You ain't never forgot that, have you, Mikey?" "No, sir," I said, and although I hadn't thought about it in 3 years or better, I added what he sometimes said. "It hasn't ever escaped my mind." "Well, I'll tell you now," he said. 15 is old enough, I guess, and your mother ain't here to stop me. Besides, you ought to know. I think something like it could only have happened in Derry, and you need to know that, too, so you can beware. The conditions for such things have always seemed right here. You're careful, aren't you, Mikey?"
"Yes, sir," I said.
"Good," he said, and his head dropped back on his pillow. "That's good." I thought he was going to drift off again. His eyes had slipped closed. But instead, he began to talk. "When I was at the Army base here in 29 and 30, he said, "there was an NCO club up there on the hill where Derry Community College is now. It was right behind the PX where you used to be able to get a pack of Lucky Strike greens for 7 cents. The NCO club was only a big old Quonset hut, but they had fixed it up nice inside. Carpet on the floor, booths along the walls, a jukebox, and you could get soft drinks on the weekend. If you were white, that was. They would have bands in most Saturday nights, and it was quite a place to go. It was just pop over the bar, it being prohibition, but we heard you could get stronger stuff if you wanted it, and if you had a little green star on your army card. That was like a secret sign they had. Homebrew beer mostly, but on weekends you could sometimes get stronger stuff, if you were white. Us Company E boys weren't allowed any place near it, of course. So we went on the town if we had a pass in the evening. In those days, Derry was still something of a logging town, and there were 8 or 10 bars, most of them down in a part of town they called Hell's Half Acre. They wasn't speakeasies. That was too grand a name for 'em. Wasn't anybody in 'em spoke very easy anyhow. They was what folks called blind pigs. And that was about right, because most of the customers acted like pigs when they were in there, and they was about blind when they turned 'em out. The sheriff knew and the cops knew, but those places roared all night long, same as they'd done since the logging days in the 1890s. I suppose palms got greased, but maybe not as many or with so much as you might think. In Derry, people have a way of looking the other way. Some served hard stuff as well as beer, and by all accounts I ever heard, the stuff you could get in town was 10 times as good as the rot-gut whiskey and bathtub gin you could get at the White Boys NCO on Friday and Saturday nights. The downtown hooch came over the border from Canada in pulp trucks, and most of them bottles had what the label said. The good stuff was expensive, but there was plenty of furnace oil, too, and it might hang you over, but it didn't kill you, and if you did go blind, it didn't last. On any given night, you'd have to duck your head when the bottles came flying by. There was Nan's, the Paradise, Wally's Spa, the Silver Dollar, and one bar, the Powderhorn, where you could sometimes get a whore. Oh, you could pick up a woman at any pig. You didn't even have to work at it that hard. There was a lot of them wanted to find out if a slice off on the rye loaf was any different. But to kids like me and Trevor Dawson and Carl Roone, my friends in those days, the thought of buying a whore, a white whore, that was something you had to sit down and consider. As I've told you, he was heavily doped that night. I don't believe he would have said any of that stuff, not to his 15-year-old son, if he had not been. Well, it wasn't very long before a representative of the town council showed up, wanting to see Major Fuller. He said he wanted to talk about some problems between the townspeople and the enlisted men, and concerns of the electorate, and questions of propriety, but what he really wanted Fuller to know was as clear as a window pane.
They didn't want no army niggers in their pigs, bothering white women and drinking illegal hooch at a bar where only white men were supposed to be standing and drinking illegal hooch. All of which was a laugh, all right. The flower of white womanhood they were so worried about was mostly a bunch of bar bags. And as far as getting in the way of the men, well, all I can say is that I never saw a member of the Derry Town Council down in the Silver Dollar or in the Powderhorn. The men who drank in those dives were pulp cutters in those big red and black checked lumbermen's jackets, scars and scabs all over their hands, some of them missing eyes or fingers, all of them missing most of their teeth, all of them smelling like wood chips and sawdust and sap. They wore green flannel pants and green gum rubber boots and tracked snow across the floor until it was black with it. They smelled big, Mikey, and they walked big, and they talked big. They were big. I was in Wally Spa one night when I saw a fella split his shirt right down one arm while he was arm-wrestling this other fella. It didn't just rip. You probably think that's what I mean, but it ain't. Arm of that man's shirt damn near exploded, sort of blew off his arm in rags. And everybody cheered and applauded, and somebody slapped me on the back and said, "That's what you call an arm wrestler's fart, blackface." What I'm telling you is that if the men who use those blind pigs on Friday and Saturday nights when they come out of the woods to drink whiskey and fuck women instead of knot holes greased up with lard, if those men hadn't wanted us there, they would have thrown us out on our asses. But the fact of it was, Mikey, they didn't seem to give much of a toot one way or the other. One of them took me aside one night. He was 6 foot, which was damn big for those days, and he was dead drunk, and he smelled as high as a basket of month-old peaches. If he'd stepped out of his clothes, I think they would have stood up alone. He looks at me and says, "Mister, I'm going to ask you something, me. Are you be a Negro?" "That's right," I says. "Como ça va?" he says in the St. John Valley French that sounds almost like Cajun talk, and grins so big I saw all four of his teeth. "I knew you was, me. Hey, I seen one in a book once. Had the same..." And he couldn't think how to say what was on his mind, so he reaches out and flaps at my mouth. "Big lips," I says. "Yeah, yeah," he says, laughing like a kid. "Big lips. Epais lèvres. Big lips. Gonna buy you a beer, me?" "Buy away," I says, not wanting to get on his bad side. He laughed at that, too, and clapped me on the back, almost knocking me on my face, and pushed his way up to the plankwood bar, where there must have been 70 men and maybe 15 women lined up. "I need 2 beers for I tear this dump apart," he yells at the bartender, who is a big lug with a broken nose named Romeo Dupree. "One for me and one pour l'homme avec les épées lèvres." And they all laughed like hell at that, but not in a mean way, Mikey. So he gets the beers and gives me mine, and he says, "What's your name? I don't want to call you Big Leaps, me. Don't sound good." "William Hanlon," I says. "Well, here's to you, William Hanlon," he says. "No, here's to you," I says. "You're the first white man who ever bought me a drink," which was true. So we drank those beers down, and then we had 2 more, and he says, "You sure you're a Negro? Except for them épais lips, you look just like a white man with brown skin to me." My father got to laughing at this, and so did I. He laughed so hard his stomach started to hurt him, and he held it, grimacing, his eyes turned up, his upper plate biting down on his lower lip. "You want me to ring for the nurse, Daddy?" I asked, alarmed. "No, no. I'm going to be okay. The worst thing of this, Mikey, is that you can't even laugh anymore when you feel like it, which is damn seldom." He fell silent for a few moments, and I realized now that that was the only time we came close to talking about what was killing him. Maybe it would have been better for both of us, if we had done more. He took a sip of water and then went on. "Anyway, it wasn't the few women who traveled the pigs, and it wasn't the lumberjacks that made up their main custom who wanted us out. It was those 5 old men and the town council who were really offended, them and the dozen or so men that stood behind them. Derry's old line, you know. None of them had ever stepped a foot inside of the Paradise or Wally's Spa. They did their boozing at the country club, which then stood over on Derry Heights. But they wanted to make sure that none of those bar bags or peavey swingers got polluted by the blacks of Company E. So Major Fuller says, I never wanted them here in the first place. I keep thinking it's an oversight and they'll get sent back down south or maybe to New Jersey. That's not my problem, this old fart tells him. Mueller, I think his name was. Sally Mueller's father? I asked, startled. Sally Mueller was in the same high school class with me. My father grinned a sour, crooked little grin. No, this would have been her uncle. Sally Mueller's dad was off in college somewhere then. But if he'd been in Barrie, he would have been there, I guess, standing with his brother. And in case you're wondering how true this part of the story is, all I can tell you is that the conversation was repeated to me by Trevor Dawson, who was swabbing the floors over there in officers' country that day and heard it all. Where the government sends the black boys is your problem, not mine, Mueller tells Major Fuller. My problem is where you're letting them go on Friday and Saturday nights. If they go on whooping it up downtown, there's going to be trouble. We've got the Legion in this town, you know. Well, but I am in a bit of a tight here, Mr. Mueller, he says. I can't let them drink over at the NCO club. Not only is it against the regulations for the Negroes to drink with the whites, they couldn't anyway. It's an NCO club, don't you see? Every one of those black boys is a bucky tail private. That's not my problem either. I simply trust you will take care of the matter. Responsibility accompanies rank. And off he goes. Well, Fuller solved the problem. The Derry Army base was a damn big patch of land in those days, although there wasn't a hell of a lot on it. Better than 100 acres, all told. Going north, it ended right behind West Broadway, where a sort of green belt was planted. Where Memorial Park is now, that was where the black spot stood. It was just an old requisition shed in early 1930 when all of this happened, but Major Fuller mustered in Company E and told us it was going to be our club. Acted like he was Daddy Warbucks or something, and maybe he even felt that way, giving a bunch of black privates their own place, even if it was nothing but a shed. Then he added, like it was nothing, that the pigs downtown were off limits to us. There was a lot of bitterness about it, but what could we do? We had no real power. It was this young fellow, a PFC named Dick Halloran, who was a mess cook, who suggested that maybe we could fix it up pretty nice if we really tried. So we did. We really tried. And we made out pretty well, all things considered. The first time a bunch of us went in there to look it over, we were pretty depressed. It was dark and smelly, full of old tools and boxes of papers that had gone moldy. There was only two little windows and no electricity. The floor was dirt. Carl Roon laughed in a kind of bitter way, I remember that, and said, The old mage. He a real prince, ain't he? Give us our own club. So. And George Brannock, who was also killed in the fire that fall, he said, Yeah, it's a hell of a black spot, all right. And the name just stuck. Halloran got us going, though. Halloran and Carl and me. I guess God will forgive us for what we did, though, because he knows we had no idea how it would turn out. After a while, the rest of the fellows pitched in. With most of Derry off limits, there wasn't much else we could do. We hammered and nailed and cleaned. Trev Dawson was a pretty good jackleg carpenter, and he showed us how to cut some more windows along the side. And damned if Alan Snopes didn't come up with panes of glass for them that were different colors, sort of a cross between carnival glass and the sort you see in church windows. Where'd you get this? I asked him. Alan was the oldest of us. He was about 42, old enough so that most of us called him Pop Snopes. He stuck a camel in his mouth and tipped me a wink. Midnight requisitions, he says, and would say no more. So the place come along pretty good, and by the middle of summer we was using it. Trev Dawson and some of the others had partitioned off the back quarter of the building and got a little kitchen set up in there, not much more than a grill and a couple of deep fryers, so that you could get a hamburger and some French fries if you wanted. There was a bar down one side, but it was just meant for sodas and drinks like Virgin Mary's. Shit, we knew our place. Hadn't we been taught it? If we wanted to drink hard, we'd do it in the dark. The floor was still dirt, but we kept it oiled down nice. Trev and Pop Snopes ran in electric line. More midnight requisitions, I imagine. By July, you could go in there any Saturday night and sit down and have a cola and a hamburger or a slaw dog. It was nice. It never really got finished. We were still working on it when the fire burned it down. It got to be a kind of hobby, or a way of thumbing our noses at Fuller and Mueller and the town council. But I guess we knew it was ours when Ev McCaslin and I put up a sign one Friday night that said, "The Black Spot," and just below that, "Company E and Guests," like we were exclusive, you know. It got looking nice enough that the white boys started to grumble about it, and next thing you know, the white boys' NCO was looking finer than ever. They was adding on a special lounge and a little cafeteria. It was like they wanted to race, but that was one race that we didn't want to run. My dad smiled at me from his hospital bed. We were young, except for Snopesy, but we weren't entirely foolish. We knew that the white boys let you race against them, but if it starts to look like you are getting ahead, why, somebody just breaks your leg so you can't run as fast. We had what we wanted, and that was enough. But then, something happened. He fell silent, frowning. "What was that, Daddy?" "We found out that we had a pretty decent jazz band among us," he said slowly. "Martin Devereaux, who was a corporal, played drums. A. Stevenson played cornet. Pop Snopes played a pretty decent barrel house piano. He wasn't great, but he wasn't no slouch either. There was another fellow who played clarinet, and George Brannock played the saxophone. There were others of us who sat in from time to time, playing guitar or harmonica or juice harp or even just a comb with waxed paper over it. This didn't all happen at once, you understand, but by the end of that August, there was a pretty hot little Dixieland combo playing Friday and Saturday nights at the Black Spot. They got better and better as the fall drew on, and while they were never great, I don't want to give you that idea, they played in a way that was different, hotter somehow. He waved his skinny hand above the bedclothes. "They played bodacious," I suggested, grinning. "That's right," he exclaimed, grinning back. "You got it. They played bodacious Dixieland. And the next thing you know, people from town started to show up at our club. Even some of the white soldiers from the base. It got so the place was getting crowded a right smart every weekend. That didn't happen all at once, either. At first, those white faces looked like sprinkles of salt in a pepper pot, but more and more of them turned up as time went on. When those white people showed up, that's when we forgot to be careful. They were bringing in their own booze in brown bags, most of it the finest high-tension stuff there is, made the stuff you could get in the pigs downtown look like soda pop. Country club booze is what I mean, Mikey. Rich people's booze. Chivas, Glenfiddich. The kind of champagne they served to first-class passengers on ocean liners. Champers, some of them called it. Same as we used to call ugly-minded mules back home. We should have found a way to stop it, but we didn't know how. They was town. Hell, they was white. And like I said, we were young and proud of what we'd done. And we underestimated how bad things might get. We all knew that Mueller and his friends must have known what was going on, but I don't think any of us realized that it was driving them crazy. And I mean what I say, crazy. There they were in their grand old Victorian houses on West Broadway, not a quarter of a mile away from where we were, listening to things like Aunt Hagar's Blues and Digging My Potatoes. That was bad. Knowing that the young people were there, too, whooping it up right cheek to jowl with the blacks, that must have been ever so much worse. Because it wasn't just the lumberjacks and the bar bags that were turning up as September came into October. It got to be kind of a thing in town. Young folks would come to drink and to dance to that no-name jazz band until one in the morning came and shut us down. They didn't just come from Derry, either. They come from Bangor and Newport and Haven and Cleves Mills and Old Town and all the little burgs around these parts. You could see fraternity boys from the University of Maine at Orono cutting capers with their sorority girlfriends, and when the band learned how to play a ragtime version of the Maine Stein song, they just about ripped the roof off. Of course, it was an enlisted man's club, technically at least, and off limits to civilians who didn't have an invitation. But in fact, Mikey, we just opened the door at 7 and let her stand open until 1. By the middle of October, it got so that any time you went out on the dance floor, you were standing hip to hip with 6 other people. There wasn't no room to dance, so you had to just sort of stand there and wiggle. But if anyone minded, I never heard him let on. By midnight, it was like an empty freight car rocking and reeling on an express run. He paused, took another drink of water, and then went on. His eyes were bright now.
Well, well, Fuller would have put an end to it sooner or later. If it had been sooner, a lot less people would have died. All he had to do was send in MPs and have them confiscate all the bottles of liquor that people had brought in with them. That would have been good enough. Just what he wanted, in fact. It would have shut us down good and proper. There would have been court-martials and the stockade in Rye for some of us, and transfers for all the rest. But Fuller was slow. I think he was afraid of the same thing some of us was afraid of, that some of the townies would be mad. Mueller hadn't been back to see him, and I think Major Fuller must have been scared to go downtown and see Mueller. He talked big, Fuller did, but he had all the spine of a jellyfish. So instead of the thing ending in some put-up way that would have at least left all those that burned up that night still alive, the Legion of Decency ended it. They came in their white sheets early that November and cooked themselves a barbecue. He fell silent again, not sipping at his water this time, only looking moodily into the far corner of his room while outside a bell dinged softly somewhere and a nurse passed the open doorway, the soles of her shoes squeaking on the linoleum. I could hear a TV someplace, a radio someplace else. I remember that I could hear the wind blowing outside, snuffling up the side of the building. And although it was August, the wind made a cold sound. It knew nothing of Kane's Hundred on the television or the Four Seasons singing Walk Like a Man on the radio. Some of them came through that green belt between the base and West Broadway, he resumed at last. They must have met at someone's house over there, maybe in the basement, to get their sheets on and to make the torches that they used. I've heard that others came right onto the base by Ridgeline Road, which was the main way onto the base back then. I heard, I won't say where, that they came in a brand new Packard automobile, dressed in their white sheets with their white goblin hats on their laps and torches on the floor. The torches were Louisville sluggers with big hunks of burlap snugged down over the fat parts with red rubber gaskets, the kind ladies use when they put up preserves. There was a booth where Ridgeline Road branched off Witcham Road and came onto the base, and the O.D. passed that Packard right along. It was Saturday night, and the joint was jumping, going round and round. There might have been 200 people there, maybe three. And here came these white men, six or eight in their bottle-green Packard, and more coming through the trees between the base and the fancy houses on West Broadway. They wasn't young, not many of them, and sometimes I wonder how many cases of angina and bleeding ulcers there were the next day. I hope there was a lot. Those dirty, sneaking, murdering bastards. The Packard parked on the hill and flashed its lights twice. About four men got out of it and joined the rest. Some had those two-gallon tins of gasoline that you could buy at service stations back in those days. All of them had torches. One of them stayed behind the wheel of that Packard. Mueller had a Packard, you know. Yes, he did, a green one. They got together at the back of the black spot and doused their torches with gas. Maybe they only meant to scare us. I've heard it the other way, but I've heard it that way, too. I'd rather believe that's how they meant it, because I ain't got feeling mean enough, even yet, to want to believe the worst.
End of side 12.